This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 321 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Today's episode of the Outlander podcast is brought to you by AMC Shudder. Now, this episode, we will be starting something new. We will announce one of our co-producers who has helped make this show possible. So who are our co-producers? Well, our co-producers are those who support us on Patreon at the $10 level. And our co-producer this episode is Carlene Z.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along with chapter 94, entitled New Blood.
Bree wakes Roger up from a sound sleep to see about a man. Jamie and Claire are sleeping, too, because Jamie is, I almost said retiring. He's recuperating from his snake bite, and Claire is recuperating. Well, she's with him, but also recuperating from him almost dying, all the nursing or doctoring she's done, and she needs a break. So the man, that Bree needs Roger to go see about, says his name is Thomas Christie. And he says he was at Ardsmuir with Jamie. That gets Roger up, and she goes to tell Christie that Roger will be right out. So as Roger's getting out of bed, he finds the, quote, old wifey, the fertility charm Mrs. Bug had given them under a pillow. That's just a little tour there.
And then he's Christie, like, I'm just going to tuck that back where I found it.
Right back in. Yeah, it fell out. Let's put it back where it belongs. Christie is waiting in Jamie's speak-a-wart room with two outriders. I love the term that, I mean, it's Diana, obviously, but Diana is writing for Roger's POV, or not first person, but it's written from Roger's POV. Christie, an older man with trimly cut black hair, streaked with gray, and a dark-haired younger man of no more than 20, and a young woman. Those are his outriders. As Roger shakes Christie's hand, Christie feels him up, fingerly.
What?
A Masonic greeting.
I was like, what are you talking about? I don't remember that. And then I remembered that.
And then you did. Until she did. He was familiar with it, Roger, but he hadn't experienced it in years. So what is Christie doing there? Christie is there to find land, and Roger is agog. What the heck? This means likely Jamie is a Mason, too. Diana describes Christie's eyes as a, quote, yellowish brown color, unquote. But I swear she describes them elsewhere as gray. I know we get there later.
His daughter.
Yes, she has beautiful gray eyes. But I could have sworn that specifically he was also described with gray eyes. But I could be wrong. Christie demands to know who else on the ridge is from Ardsmuir. Roger tells him, and Christie seems to relax because he knows them, he probably knows all of them, actually. So what happened? What brought Christie here? Christie had been transported with other prisoners, but his indenture had been purchased by a plantation owner in South Carolina who had made him schoolmaster to his own children. Once the indenture had expired, he stayed on to work for wages. Oh, Roger's like, huh, schoolmaster, this would be great for the ridge and great for to take off Brianna's plate because we know she loves teaching.
I feel like I know that he does more stuff later. I feel like she introduced him purely because after the last few chapters, she's like, I don't like writing Brianna as a teacher. I need to give her an excuse to not have to do that anymore so I can stop writing about it.
So she can get pregnant.
Right. So welcome back, Tom Christie.
Is that okay? So I said I was joking so she can get pregnant. But isn't it funny that now that I say that or think about it, that he finds the little fertility. I almost said chamber. Mm-mm. No, the fertility chamber is called the vagina. He finds the fertility
idol, like the little tchotchke.
Fertility tchotchke is semen. Come on, get your things together.
No, it's not. What's fertility wrong with you?
Fertility figure. That's the word.
Oh my goodness.
Is the little old wifey. The old wifey under the pillow. So it's funny that I made a joke not thinking about it that I realized, oh, maybe. I mean, they go together. They came in the same chapter. Who knows?
All the best characters do.
Summer. Christy's wife had died of the flu, as did the owner. I'm guessing he means his owner or the indentured. His indenture, it's only good for so many years, mm-hmm. however long it takes for him to pay it off. Once it had either ended or he paid it off, he stayed on and was paid wages, but he did the same job.
Yes.
Christy is describing he doesn't give any dates. Prison, then the transport, and then the working off the indenture and then paying wages. That's in order. That's chronological. That's chronological. But this next part is not necessarily chronological. He says that his wife died of the flu. We have no idea what he if he means that happened like before Culloden, during Culloden, after Culloden, on the way over. You know, we don't know when. We just know that his wife died of the flu. That's what he says. And the owner, I'm guessing he means, and that could be my error in typing, but I believe he means the man that he worked for.
I think you're right too, but I think that it's also for the purpose of clarity because he never gave him a name. So if he's describing
of the man,
no, of the man who owned his indenture,
correct?
The man who, So they didn't name him. So the only way to mention with ease of everyone to figure it out of who it was that died also along with his wife. There's no other way to describe him.
We don't know why. Maybe because the guy died or because his kids were all, you know, grown or had outgrown school. I don't know. But they no longer required his services. So he goes off to, and somehow, we don't know yet, somehow he hears about Jamie in the backwoods with land, right? Somehow. And he makes a good decision. He's like, well, if there's one place I can probably get some land and have a place of my own, it's probably there. So Roger has never done this before. He's watched Jamie. He's probably been in the room with him while he's interviewing prospective tenants and definitely making, you know, been there when he's made the decision, filled out the paperwork, all of that, or written the papers. But he's a little unsure of himself. He doesn't know maybe everything, but he's been part of the decision or part of the process. And he just decides, he's like, look, I am not going to go wake up this man who's like, still, maybe, you never know, on death's door. You know, he's a little bit better, but he's still not out of the woods yet. So I'm not going to wake him up and I'm not going to wake up Claire. They both need their rest. But this guy, like, I can't, you know, I don't want to leave him and his outriders waiting.
He didn't want to do that. But it's also that once, didn't he? He knew about he was from Ardsmuir before he went in the room, right?
In the speaker room?
Yeah, before he went in there. Didn't they say there's someone here to see Jamie? He was at Ardsmuir. Or did that come later? I just feel like he understands that there's
he knew there was a certain connection, whatever that was. He didn't know how close or not. He just knew there was an Ardsmuir connection, and that is a thing. It's a big thing.
Yeah, and that's like, you know, those are the VIPs at the Ridge.
Correct. So Roger makes the decision. He will approve him as his tenant, as a tenant. Bree comes in just at that time, almost like she's waiting for it to like, congratulations, and brings biscuits and beer. So we learn that Christy's son is named Alan. His daughter is named Mulva. Now,
I completely forgot about Mulva. Malva. I remember the Malva from the books to come. So whenever I hear the name, I instantly go, Malva. And it happened again because I completely forgot that this is when we get introduced to Malva.
And without saying any judgment of her character, are you a Malva fan?
No. I mean, okay. I think we're all predisposed to not like her anyway because of her name. It's real close to vulva.
And Melba, like Melba toast. That stuff's not bad.
That's not bad.
So he believed Melva. Now I'm saying Melva. He believed Malva was tall because she was sitting, I think, and she appeared to have long limbs. But he believed she was probably tall, maybe between 17 and 18 years old. And she had curly black hair and a pale oval face. And since girls on the Ridge were girls of marriageable age, does that make sense? And unmarried ones at that were a rarity. It wouldn't take long, he thought, for her to have some offers. He organizes the tenant contracts and he signs for Jamie. Quote, he felt a deep, pleasant glow of accomplishment, a sound tenant, and willing to pay his half quit rent by serving as schoolmaster for 5 months of the year. Jamie himself, Roger thought complacently, would not have done better. Unquote. And then I wrote,
how many H's is that?
I wrote ha 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 a few of them, but I don't know how many I did, but I didn't do as many. They don't match, put it that way. He calls Lizzie and asks her to take the noobs to Evan Lindsay's cabin to stay for a bit until they can get something for them for something to set up for them. Roger mentions, quote, as soon as he is feeling better, unquote, when speaking about Jamie, which clues in the noobs that he's not gone, but rather sick.
Incapacitated.
Yep. Malva speaks to Roger and he sees her beauty, her gray eyes. So here we are told gray eyes. So it could just be her. But I thought it was also Christy, but I could be wrong. Then once again, welcomes Christy to the Ridge. Now, later when Jamie was awake and could hold court, Roger goes to him. He tells him what he did. Quote, for a split second, Roger felt as though all the air in the room had been removed by a vacuum, freezing everything. Fraser stared at him, expressionless. Then he nodded, his expression of pleasant interest restored as though by magic, and normal time resumed. Unquote. So the reader, and probably Roger, are like, what the fudge just happened? We'll find out maybe one day. One day, maybe.
And that's what he said, like the very last line of this chapter was him thinking, what on earth was the matter with Tom Christie?
Mm-hmm. As Roger leaves court, quote, everything seemed perfectly all right, and yet he felt obscurely uneasy, unquote. And yes, of course, Claire had noticed it too. And then as Summer said, as he left, it was like, what the F is wrong with Tom Christie?
Something's wrong with that boy. Man, dude. And that was chapter 94. Moving right along to chapter 95, entitled The Summer Dim.
And I was looking at it, writing down, and I almost wrote dim sum. The next day, and this is probably, oh, Lord have mercy. I didn't, when we first, or Summer first, I think she does that typically, lays out the whole book in chapters and chapter numbers, chapter names, and the number of pages for each chapter. I do look at that when I, you know, schedule everything. Because it is not our ideal to have this many pages per chapter. I'm sorry, per episode. But like I said, when Stars lets us know their dates, we have to jigger it and make sure everything, you know, works, which means we have toward the end, like almost every single time, quite episodes that have a lot more, at least more pages in it and definitely more chapters. Typically.
Well, because it's become a sprint.
Yeah.
It's no longer, you know, a cross-country race or a long race. It's a sprint.
So what I was going to say was, out of all four of the ones we're discussing in this episode, is by far the longest. And I was going through going, oh my gosh, is it almost done? Nope. Oh, okay. A few more pages. Oh, okay. It looks like it's wrapping up. Nope. I mean, oh my gosh. It was on and on and on. So the next day, Roger is having flashes of his time in Oxford again as a professor, and he's going out to cut down, or I guess cut with an axe, some hay, like on some rise somewhere. There's work to be done on the ridge, so he had to get. So he goes on a wander to chop this hay, and he gets there and he starts, and as he gets into the rhythm, he thinks on some of the stuff that Jamie had told him the night he almost died. Some of the stuff he'd known, but other stuff he hadn't. For example, Claire. All we heard a few chapters ago about Claire was he said, tell Claire I meant it, right? That's all we're told, the reader. Well, now we're told some of the details that, or I should say, well, yeah, specifics that he told Roger. He said, quote, if I am dead, she must leave. Send her. Make her go. You should all go if the Baron can pass, but she must go. Make her go to the stones. Unquote. Huh? Because it's dangerous. Oh, sorry. I completely did that wrong. Huh? He doesn't understand this. And Jamie's like, look, it's dangerous for her here. if I am not around to protect her. Quote. What?
He's just like, no one else can protect her.
That's true.
She is a danger to herself and everyone around her.
That's been the same since she came through the phones, exactly. Since she came through the stones in the first time. Absolutely. Mostly because of her mouth, but yes. Well, back then because of her mouth. Now, who knows? A lot of things. And this is not anti-Claire, anti-feminist. It's just she forever gets into trouble. Quote, she is an old one. They will kill her if they knew. Unquote. Jamie had been speaking in English, which, of course, thank you, because we understand it. But Roger thought it was too bad because if he had been speaking in Gaelic and the term he had used for old one, if he had used a certain one, banshee, it would have been a lot more specific. I believe banshee literally means woman fairy. So while Roger was cynical about that sort of thing, all of the you know, fairies and that kind of thing, he knows that he wouldn't have dared disturb, say, milk set out for the others or a charm put out by someone to protect their crop or to protect their animals. So he, while he himself seems not to be superstitious, he respects that others are. And he's got a little bit of something in him that he's, first of all, he's not an icky day to go around just bashing stuff for the heck of it. It was like, that's stupid. Boom. But also, he's respectful of what they do and how meaningful it is to them. But also, from my reading, and tell me if you got this as well, almost like a, just in case there is something to it, I'm not only going to respect it because someone else did it, and that's their belief, I'm also going to, like, you know, maybe walk a little ways around it. And, you know, I not only respect it, but also, like, make extra sure I don't disturb it because I don't want that bad juju.
So you're saying if you walked across something that was an offering for something.
Not me, Roger.
Okay. Because it sounded like you were asking me to tell you about, to agree with you on something.
No.
Okay.
I'm asking me. Ginger, what did you have for lunch today?
This would not surprise me.
Well, let me tell you, I had couscous and I had some grilled veggies and I had 2 hard-boiled eggs. What did you have?
What did I have? I had a salad.
Okay, very good. So what I was asking you was, Summer, when you were reading this, did you also get that Diana was implying that Roger not only avoided things or, you know, didn't disturb the charms he saw laid out or whatever, because he had respect for the people and their own beliefs, but also he didn't want to, like, get some bad juju in case, just in case there's something to it.
Well, yes. But I mean, that I personally identify with that as well. Just because you don't.
Bad juju?
Well, not just, you know, juju or voodoo or any of those things, but it's just like,
or hoo-hoo.
It's like, what if? It's just the game of what if. And if it doesn't outweigh, if the bad that could happen is outweighed by the good things, then, you know, then you can think about doing it, but otherwise not at all, because you don't want to be on the bad side of one of those things if it's true, right?
Yeah, totally.
So completely. I think they're just hedging your bets, right?
I can get that. And they were different. Claire, Roger, Bree, and Jem, and the others. Galus, Ottertooth, etc. Speaking of whom, Jamie had buried the head, the first resident of the future Fraser's Ridge Cemetery. And that makes Roger think. He imagines that one day they might all lie there in the cemetery if they don't all go back. And Roger wonders, quote, what on earth would they carve for dates, unquote. And I thought, come on, historian, you should know this. Yes, gems is easy for literal dates, but you know your birth year, your birthday and year, just to minus approximately 200 years or adjust it for years in the 18th century. Don't make it difficult. It's not that hard. But there's a big question. The big question is whether or not Jem can pass through the stones.
Come on. Don't you think it'd be funny if you walked up to a graveyard and you looked at a tombstone and it was like, born 1945, dead 1779. It'd be like, wait,
that would
what?
Be odd. Yes, exactly. That would be odd. And then he thinks, oh my gosh, that fertility figure. Not only do we have like Jem to worry about not being able to go through the stones, maybe. We also have, what if we have another baby? There's no guarantee that baby could go through the stones. So it's like, oh my gosh. So he's chopping the hay, chopping the hay and also girdling a tree or girdling some trees. Getting ready to girdle a tree, Kenny Lindsay comes up to him and they speak of Christy. There's another reaction to the name and he just comes out and asks, what the heck is up with Christy? Like, I'm getting all these things. And Kenny's not very forthcoming with answers either. Quote, the sense of unease about Christy persisted. Unquote.
What happens in Ardsmuir stays in Ardsmuir.
Apparently. It's like Vegas. Apparently. Unless you touch each other up fingerly. Yes.
That, what?
Then
did somebody say
Lindsay.
That?
I said that.
Okay. So how do you?
Then
never mind.
He gave Lindsay the Masonic greeting. He touched him up fingerly. That's the third time I've said that now. He gawks, Lindsay does, and he does it right back. Surprised, Roger said, Christy too. All of the Ardsmuir men were brothers, and it was started by Jamie. Now that they were Masonic brothers, Lindsay apparently feels he can gab. I'm like, oh, that's all you needed? Fine, I'm a brother.
Well, it's a level of,
I'm not
it's
a brother,
an added level of trust, right? And
yes.
it was a really smart move for Jamie because it's forced bonding, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a really smart move on his behalf to kind of unite everyone under a single, well, I guess not religion because they weren't ever going to be the same religion, but like under a single flag. So they were all brothers in a different way. But I have a question.
Okay.
When did Jamie become a Freemason?
Oh, you didn't get that? I'll mention it.
Okay, because I was like, I couldn't tell when I was listening to it. And maybe I just missed a word because, you
it's
know.
It's not a word, it's a passage, but yes.
No. Because I remember him coming back to the cell and then starting his first Ardsmuir group one of, or group two. So yeah. I don't remember where he came from before that. And I didn't know if that was directly to do with what happened in the room that night or if. Or if it would just happen to coincide.
We shall see. AMC Networks Shudder is a premium streaming video service super serving members with the best selection in genre entertainment, covering horror, thrillers, and the supernatural. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and supernatural for $5.99 a month or $56.99 a year.
Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing, human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. It's the Netflix for horror. Shudder features the best movies, One Cut of the Dead, and best horror movie of 2019, Tigers Are Not Afraid, according to Rotten Tomatoes.
You'll have unlimited access to stream ad-free on all your favorite devices, including iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, Google Chromecast, and Roku.
Shudder has a unique collection of exclusive and original films and series, horror classics, and blockbuster hits, including one of my personal new obsessions, Creepshow TV series, produced by Greg Nicotero of The Walking Dead.
So I thought it would be too easy for us to say, you know, like what we really like about Shudder. Of course, the easy one is, of course, A Discovery of Witches, which streams. You can binge watch on Shudder, but we want to talk about some of the stuff that's a little bit newer and also very unique to Shudder. And something that I have recently checked out is Mandy, a film from 2018 starring Nicolas Cage. This is a horror film about a boyfriend who seeks and gets revenge for the murder of his girlfriend. It involves like biker gangs and cult sacrifice and so much. But Nicolas Cage's performance was quite acclaimed for the show. Shudder has a vast selection of content, extensive international library, range of genres and types of movies, from old classics to modern favorites.
Get started streaming the best horror, thriller, and supernatural content. Shudder's expertly curated collection includes titles like the acclaimed Tigers Are Not Afraid, One Cut of the Dead, Revenge, and the acclaimed Creepshow TV series produced by Greg Nicotero, and the all-new series The Deadlands premiering this January.
To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com and use promo code Outlander. That's shudder.com. Promo code Outlander. Lindsay then opens up a little bit. So he was surprised to see Christy there, because he didn't get on very well with Jamie. And if he'd had another place to go, he doesn't think he would have come here. Quote, Roger was momentarily surprised by the revelation that there was someone from Artsmuir who didn't think the sun shone out of Jamie Fraser's arse. Unquote. That's probably my favorite line of the chapter. All Lindsay would tell him was that Christy was Protestant. So, okay, maybe that for some people, that's enough. And then we get a little more of the story. So Christy, Protestant though he was a Jacobite arrested after Culloden. Lindsay invites Roger in and he's like, let's tell you the whole story. Christy was a Lowlander. During the Rising, he was a merchant in the city being Edinburgh. He got for himself the contract to provide food for the Highland Army. And when the army left Edinburgh, Christy went along. And he left the army the day before Culloden, but he was, you know, traveling pretty slowly. And he ran into government troops on the way back to the city. So he was arrested and brought back to Ardsmuir. Small groups had formed within the prison, of course, for self-protection, which is understandable. And there was lots of conflict. There were Calvinists led by Christy, who were self-righteous. And then came Jamie, and they brought him by boat, which is, of course, his favorite mode of transportation. He arrived and was immediately sick because boat. And they could tell from the way he carried himself, acted, he was a gentleman, a laird, and a warrior, and he was very respected among the Highlanders. And the fact that people came to view Jamie as protector and leader really ticked Christy off. Because Christy, up until that point, had kind of been that, he had been a leader. He still was a leader. The new governor of Ardsmuir, Harry Quarry, this is pre-John, gave his prisoners a bit of respect. And he, quote, knew Jamie Fraser by repute, regarding him as an honorable, if defeated, foe, unquote. After they met, Quarry and Jamie, he was ordered, obviously, but Quarry and Jamie had a standing appointment. He would come, they would chat, talk about what the men needed, the status of things, and he would, they would have dinner. And Jamie would get to shave and wash up and then go on his date. Roger formed this picture of Christy, ambitious, intelligent, and envious. And problems continued. Now, one night, Fraser summoned a few of them. He'd found out somehow, and we still don't know how, we aren't told this, that Christy was a Freemason. So Jamie founds a new lodge that night. Now, how had Jamie become Freemason, let alone a master? It was Quarry. Quarry was a master, and he had made Jamie into a Mason, and Jamie had studied and done whatever is done to go up the levels, and he had become a master, I think, in a matter of months. And now that he was a master, he could set up his own lodge.
Oh my God, how did I black out that entire section of that chapter?
That's what I said. It wasn't a word. It wasn't a word. Like, maybe I missed a word. No, it wasn't a word.
I must have been looking for my exit on the freeway.
Is this like Dumbs of Autumn?
Maybe.
Not quite.
But it's just today. But it's a different perception.
It's not a different type of thing. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how he got to be the level he was. And I just found it. It's like Mambo number 5. Ardsmuir Lodge number 2. I'm just like, it just made me laugh, the name. So that night they founded a new lodge, Ardsmuir Lodge number 2. Within 3 months, all men were made apprentices. Quote, Freemasons held as basic principles the notions of equality and tolerance. No discussion of politics or religion among the brothers. That was their rule, unquote. And then we quickly, pretty briefly, are switched to Claire's POV. Now, after bothering Jamie with clinical prodding, she asks him, look, what the heck is up with Christy? Why are you being like this? What's so weird? He's like, I can't share this kind of thing with someone who makes me live on bread and milk. And she is like, whatever. She bribes him with pottage and honey. And he's like, you know that Murchison dude? The one who was killed by Bonnet, the one who had that relationship. Speaking of Dumbs of Autumn, the one who had the relationship with the white washerwoman.
Right? Oh.
That was Murchison. He was killed in book 4, right? Yeah. Now I'm saying Dumbs of Autumn for the title. Dumbs of Autumn. Oh, gracious. Well, Murchison, the reason I bring that up, just so you know who I'm talking about, right? He was a twin. And Murchison was at Ardsmuir. That's why he already had the hates for Jamie. or the anti-Jamies for Jamie. He was a twin. Now we know why he even probably hated Jamie for the most of his reason. The two together, and probably apart, were very cruel. Bonnet killed one, the Murchison we were introduced to, and Jamie had killed the other. So how did this happen? What happened? And what does that have to do with Christie? Well, as we have mentioned before, these prisoners of Ardsmuir were used for labor, right? They'd go out, I don't know, pick up, dig stuff, whatever. They were taken out just to keep them busy, keep them, you know, out of trouble. And probably getting stuff that the British Army would use, probably. They would go out, work all day, and then come back at night. Well, in the summer, when the sun went down, but the sky never got dark for very long, it would stay kind of bright until like 11 or so. They would have longer days. They would keep working. This is how Diana explains it. And so they would go home and they'd be just dead tired and get, you know, maybe a little bit less sleep, but had to start all over the next day. So this is one of those days where they worked extra long because the sun was out longer. They're still in chains. Don't forget, they're in chains, or, you know, cuffs, I want to say handcuffs, not like modern handcuffs, but, you know, dangle chains between the cuffs. And they were working there at the quarry. Murchison had poked at Jamie. Like it was time to go. They were picking up, putting everything back in the wagon. And Jamie or someone had left a maul, like a tool on the ground. Murchison poked him to pick it up and then turned around. Jamie was like, that was the last fox, probably. He turns around.
Last straw?
Fox. And he, like I said, he turns around. Then Jamie turns around. So Murchison didn't see him coming. And he puts his dangle chains around his neck, pulls, and he had no chance. And he strangles Murchison and dumps him over the edge of the quarry into the quarry pool. And he tied him to one of the blocks and then threw him into the quarry pool. Everyone went back to the prison as if nothing had happened, except two people in his group had seen what he had done. They were Christie and Duncan Innes.
Dun, dun, dun. That was chapter 95. We are now moving into part 9, A Dangerous Business, and beginning that one with chapter 96 entitled Aurum.
Claire is enjoying a late afternoon in a patch of sunlight with Adso. She's writing in her casebook. Now, we also learn that Christie has arthritis in both hands, but she's also, he had some contracture, like some curling up of some of his fingers, and she's pretty sure it's something called Dupuytren's contracture, which is actually genetic. Dupuytren's contracture is a hand deformity that usually develops over years. The condition affects a layer of tissue that lies under the skin of your palm. Knots of tissue under the skin eventually creating a thick cord that can pull one or more fingers into a bent position. So that is from the mayoclinic.org, and we will include that in the show notes. Thus far, the Christies were good tenants, and so that tells us something, I guess. Adso could not resist any type of hair. Any hair, even wigs. And we learned of an incident where he'd gone after Major McDonald's wig, like absconded with it and ran under the house with it. And she was the one who had to go get it.
And now he won't take his hat off when he comes in the house.
So she decides to draw a picture of the contracture rather than name it, because she's thinking like this guy, Dupuytren, whom it's named after, isn't even born yet. So she's like, well, better not do that, but let me get a picture in here and I'll describe what it is. At least that there's that here.
Dude, if I were Claire, I'd be naming everything after myself. Because she's finding all of them first.
Claire Fraser's. No, Claire Elizabeth Beecham Randall Fraser's contracture. That's funny. Uh-huh,
everything.
Oh, Lord, that's funny, Sam. She also wants to operate on Christie because she believes she can help him out. He's not so far gone that he's not beyond help, surgical help. Meanwhile, back in the bed or back in the house, Jamie's leg had healed pretty darn well. She's browsing, as you do, through Daniel Rawlings' notes and finds a note on the back of a page referring to his chat with Hector Cameron and his wife's I wrote referring to his chat with Hector Cameron and his wife's eyes, because Jocasta's eyes have a lot to his say. Wife's eyes.
Not for much longer.
Oh, Lord. Referring to his chat with Hector Cameron about his wife's eyes. The story about the disappearance of Dr. Rawlings is that after he was done at River Run, he set out for Virginia without his instruments and was never heard from again. He had definitely reached River Run. He had examined all the slaves and servants as well as Hector and his wife. And Claire reads the physical write-up of Hector of the exam. And he reads about the exam findings of Jocasta, specifically her progressive blindness. And the doctor had continued notes onto the back of the page in Latin. This time, more of it. It was written in very small handwriting. Was it to be extra secretive? She's like, my Latin only goes so far. I've got to get Jamie on this. So she takes the book into Jamie's speak a word room where he's writing, beginning a letter to his sister, Jenny. Jamie still feels awful about the loss of young Ian.
Just to give everyone a reminder of how big the big house is, across from Claire's surgery is Jamie's study. So I don't know how many other rooms are down there, but for the size of her surgery, for how much stuff she has, to also this house have at least double that width across, two giant rooms and probably a hallway in between. That's a huge house compared to the last house.
Okay, you're going to go there. I'm going to go there. So Summer is calling out the book version of the big house.
Yes.
If the book version of the big house, and they've got upstairs rooms, like probably two or three bedrooms, at least two, right? Lizzie's room with her dad at some point and Claire and Jamie's room. So I probably have at least two rooms, if not three rooms. I know they have two. They might have three upstairs. Downstairs is at least the kitchen, the surgery, the speaker word room, and probably some hangout room. I don't know, living room, whatever. If this is the book version of the big house, can we talk about how big the show is going to make this thing and how decorative?
Once you let go of the fact that it's not 100% historically accurate, just take a breath and look at it again and you're just like, this is gorgeous. Even if it's not 100% anything, it's still like the most gorgeous set that I can recall being on TV in recent history.
Oh my gosh. There's no shade. There's no shade about the sets. The sets are ridiculously gorgeous and amazing. It is not about the set. I mean, I don't care. I mean, yeah, it is not about the set. I can totally let go of what, especially set wise, about what the book, you know, says it has, because we know they're not going to give us anything less. At least according to, you know, architecture, they're not going to, if anything, they obviously go over and above. So you're never going to get less than what the book has in most cases. Definitely with the set, I would say. So Jamie is still feeling awful about young Ian. And understandably, Claire's a little bit impatient with Jenny, though, now. It's been like all she would have to do is give him a word or, you know, whatever. But I think it's been 6 months.
It has to have been longer than that. Ian's already like shacked up and a baby on the way in the spring. And that was from the previous November.
Yeah. And also Jem, he took off. He.
Right before Jem was born.
We don't know. I don't know exactly when Brianna was probably, I'm just guessing here, about 3 months pregnant. He took off, or they all took off. And then they came back in the book in time for her birth, for Jem's birth. So it's been, let's just say 3 months when they left. Let's say it was 6 months till the time she gave birth. And now Jem is at least about a year.
Mm-hmm.
So a year plus 6 months, it's at least 18 months that he's been gone.
Long enough to have maneuvered himself into a marriage and have a baby on the way in the spring.
Yeah, the baby doesn't take that long to start. And the marriage he has to like someone and she has to let him be there. But yeah, it's not going to be overnight. Jamie now wants to send along the message that they got from Ian. It's the only tangible it's the last link with him, and it's the only tangible evidence of his that he was at least still alive at some point in the last year or so. He wants to share that he's married and happy, and he was expecting to become a father. And then she's like, "Okay, Jamie, yeah, but this Latin." Rawlings had written, and so Jamie goes to translate for her. Rawlings had written that one night he was wakened by noises in an adjacent chamber. "It sounds like Hector needs to go to pee, so I'll follow." He calls the man, quote, "the man," unquote, and does not name him very specifically. The man goes outside, supposedly knocked out on laudanum. So, because he believes it's Hector, but he's like, "Dang, I gave that guy some heavy dose of laudanum, and he's sleepwalking here. What's going on?" He went outside, he followed him. He couldn't find Hector in the privy. And it didn't smell like anyone had used it when he went out there. So he goes back to his room, toward his room after running into Ulysses. He checks in on Cameron's room. Cameron's still like snoring in bed. And so they begin to wonder if he was an opium eater. Like, did he take so much that he had a high tolerance and then he could, you know, walk around with it, you know, with it in his system so steadily. And then that, quote, "this man next to the fleur-de-lis." So Rawlings had also drawn a little fleur-de-lis. So maybe it wasn't Hector, because next to the flower or the fleur was the chemical symbol for gold, aurum or AU, but also a Freemason's compass. Quote, "there's something very odd about the notion of a French Freemason wandering River Run by night," Jamie says.
And we'll be finishing off this week's read along with chapter 97 entitled Conditions of the Blood.
Erica B. writes, "This title leads me to believe it's a chapter on blood illnesses, and I'm curious which ones we'll get to experience. It could be interpreted to mean rules to being a member of the family or something to that effect, come to think of it, if you use alternate meanings. I'm not sure that's the case here, though." So we start out, Claire examines Lizzie, thinking that there might be an impending attack of malaria coming on. And Roger walks in with a dead turkey or turkeys. I think it was one, but I think it was just several.
One big one, like okay. A nice, decent one. Yeah, one he was crowing one. About it.
So Roger got the last laugh because it's dead, but the turkey did get in a great jab. And Roger's hand has a decent cut on it. So he's come in to show the turkey, yeah, but also to get his hand looked at. Erica B. writes, "haha, I imagine myself killing a turkey similar to the way Roger did, chasing it down. It's a funny image in my head how it went down. Involves lots of panicky gobbling." Lizzie, meanwhile, trying to escape, stops when Claire tells her to wait. Then Claire wants her blood. Erica B. writes, "I think Claire is smart to get some blood from Lizzie to check up on her disease. It feels as though Lizzie is weirded out a bit by looking at the slides."
There is a very clear reason why a modern doctor would look like they were into witchcraft in this time period. Because witches and sorcerers, or whatever you want to call them, they use like blood in a lot of their spells. They use, you know, things of like hair from people. Like, they use a lot of personal items as well as like bodily fluids to tie the spells to the people that they're trying to affect. I can totally see how something like this would get Claire burned at the stake.
Oh, blood under the microscope.
"Come here, I need your blood. I need to prick your finger." It's just for that time period, not knowing that there's a scientific reason that's behind it. I could totally see how somebody could see that as being witchcraft.
Erica B. continues, "I don't blame her, though, speaking of Lizzie, as she probably knows nothing of cells and basic biology." Claire now settles down to teach Roger about the blood. She explains that she's made some stains and she hopes that it will let her see the red blood cells and maybe what's in them. She's specifically in Lizzie's blood looking for Plasmodium vivax, the protozoan that causes malaria. She asks Roger what his blood type is. He is O positive. During this conversation, she's using the stains on the slide and basically preparing the slides. She explains the blood groups A, B, and O. Erica B. writes, I love and admire the playful banter in Roger and Clara's relationship. I think it shows how close they have become that they can take the playful tone with each other. I learned a bit from this section on blood typing, as it had been years since I last learned about it. I had no idea type B was from isolated populations. She can see Lizzie's blood cells after all, and the plasmodium. When I say that, it makes me want to say imodium.
You got a problem there?
No. She tells him her plan of checking Lizzie's blood, as in keeping tabs on Lizzie's blood to see if she can see a baseline and then see that the plasmodium increase or dramatically. She can pre-treat her or treat her, you know, just before the symptoms break out anyway, before she feels any symptoms, to help prevent a full-on breakout, blowout?
Outbreak?
There's a word. A full-on thing.
Okay.
She says that Bree's blood is type B, which is pretty rare, typically found in isolated populations, perhaps like the Scottish Highlanders. But Roger's implied question, the answer is no. She cannot tell if Jem is his by his blood.
Do you think she was just making conversation when she brought it up in the first place? Or do you think it was a pointed conversation?
I will have to go back and look at that. I didn't get either. I thought it was, we're here and there's blood. Let's talk about it. And then it just naturally, Jem. And whenever I hear Jem or read Jem, I think, whoa,
truly
Jem.
Outrageous. Truly outrageous.
Yes.
Because she's... It kind of hit me just a little weird because I was like, I could see both of the things being a thing. Like if it was her way of saying, in case you're wondering, I can't tell you. Or, you know, since we have blood here, or, you know, I'm going to bring up the blood typing thing just so, you know, let them know. There are ways to know from the blood, but I can't do it. Or if it was literally just like, haha, look, there's blood. I have blood. You have blood. What kind of blood do you have? And then kind of snowballed from there. It could have been any of those things. I had created all of those eventualities in my head.
She tells him that Bree is blood type B and Roger is OO. I'm not going to explain it or the Punnett square or anything, but because Claire does a good job of it, or I should say Diana does a good job of it, and you can read up on that. But that's...
It's literally the only thing I remember from high school biology was the Punnett square. Right?
Well, that's funny. They work out the possibilities of what Jem might be and therefore what that would mean regarding Roger being his daddy. Now, Claire says there is a serum test that would perhaps help find out at least if he definitely was not the father. And then we have a flashback to when Claire was blood type shamed, not really, by a doctor at a young Bree's appointment. Frank jumped in and said that she'd been a widow. Now, of course, what's implied there, not implied, because she was B-O, and Frank was A? I don't know. I forget what it was. But there was no way that Bree could have come from the union of Claire and Frank, is what the doctor understood and what was implied. And Frank jumps in to say, oh, she was a widow when I met her, and I adopted
the daughter. But didn't he say the actual truth? Because I was thinking about it when I was listening to it today. I was like, she did come back to him, presumably as a widow, because she thought Jamie, you know, died. So at that time period, she still thought Jamie died. So it was like a very honest statement, like unexpectedly honest statement, I should say.
Erica B. writes, I really dislike that the doctors were judgy of the blood typing for Bree like it was any other business. Imagine if that sort of thing were to happen today. I feel like they mess with the wrong person and it would be lights out for that doctor. Roger says it doesn't matter. Jem is his son. And then Adso runs off with the turkey wing.
Cat. Like a whole wing. Like he's got the whole wing off.
All right. He's got the whole wing in his mouth. He's got the whole wing in his mouth. He's got the whole wing with feathers in his mouth. He's got the whole wing in his sharp needle teeth mouth. Go at it.
I'm imagining a full-size turkey. And from what I can tell,
he did not walk off with the turkey.
Just the wing. Like he pulled a wing off of a full size turkey.
That takes some time, which means he was going at it while they were talking.
But in my brain, they've described him as a
they
kitten.
Didn't notice
one. They described him as a kitten. Still, he's still acting very much like a kitten, and no one heard. And again, no one heard it happen. It just randomly like snapped off. Like,
yeah, that's weird. Erica B. writes, I'm not sure why, but I have pride in Roger for not wanting to find out with the blood testing if Jemmy isn't his blood relation. I didn't think he would, but at least he came to the answer a lot quicker than when he had to decide if he wanted to come back for Bree, good knowing she was Lord. Pregnant and had a baby in the last book.
All right. And that was chapter 97. Join us next week when we continue our The Fiery Cross read-along with chapter 98, Clever Lad, 99, Brother, 100, oh my God, we're in the triple digits, Dead Whale, and 101, Monsters and Heroes.
Do you know what that means? Do you know how many chapters there are? Remember?
There are 111.
Yes, so we're that close.
Yeah.
Oh, baby. Oh, baby.
We will. Woo! You know what that means.
We're that close to the premiere.
Exactly. Wavelength, man. You're on my wavelength. And as always, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation on our Facebook group page, you can find us there at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And again, thank you to our sponsor this week, AMC Shudder.
And another special thanks to our co-producer for episode 321, Carlene B. Remember, you too can become a co-producer and also get all of our episodes ad-free by supporting us on Patreon. Find out more at outlanderpod.com/Patreon. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.